Welcome. My name is Julian Schlossberg, and the name of our show is Movie Talk. Welcome to part two of my interview with Joe Mantegna. This Tony Award-winning actor has starred in motion pictures on Broadway and on television, and I really think we're going to have a good time. Well, let's talk about that first movie, that short, that wonderful performance that you both do, Jack Wallace and you, in the Medusa Exchange. And by the way,
Medusa Challenger, it's called.
Medusa. Yeah, well, that's my 84-year-old slip showing.
No, that's okay.
Okay, but I wanted to tell you that it is so moving today. It's a film that stands up. It's on the web, so people listening should look at it. And let me get the title right. You say the Medusa?
Challenger. That was the name of the boat. The name of the boat was the Medusa Challenger.
And the last shot, you find that out, I think.
Yeah. What we found out was interesting is, I don't know if it made Guinness's Book of Records or anything, but at one time it was the most watched piece of film in the world because they said for some reason the Chinese had discovered that little short film. And it was like mandatory for all the students in China to watch this little short film. And so they somehow came up with the idea of it's been viewed by so many hundreds and hundreds of millions of people. Because
isn't that something?
Connection.
Well, it's a beautiful film, which made me tear up at the end. And I'm interested in knowing you're playing a mentally challenged young man. Named Joey, by the way, you're standing in traffic whizzing by. This is dangerous stuff. Yeah. Now, you know, when you make a movie, we all somehow feel we can't be hurt. Somehow we feel everything's going to be fine. But did you realize how dangerous it was?
You know, that was called kamikaze filmmaking. You got to remember, we were making this movie as part of a college film director's, you know, master's the film or whatever you want to call it. So in other words, it wasn't like it was some big Hollywood production that was coming in and had police blocking. No, we would just kind of get out there and just do it. Hope for the best. You know, that bridge in Chicago doesn't exist anymore. That's gone. That Ohio Street bridge, that drawbridge. But we just kind of showed up and just kind of did what we needed to do and waited for a lull in the traffic and jump out there and get our shots. And you know, you're young and foolish, and you just do what you do.
Did you have anything funny happen? Because obviously people don't know who you are. You're trying to sell them flowers for a dollar. Anything that didn't make the film?
So there would be some instances where I think some of the stuff made the film that actually was really happened. Like, you know, they really thought I was legitimately doing. I think there's a scene, you see a guy on a motorcycle, and a girl is on a seat behind him.
Right.
And she buys the flowers and she kisses him on the helmet. That really happened. I mean, it was just like, I'm out there, you know, banging the box, you know, flowers, you say, you know. And so people would react and do it. And the camera guys would just, you know. Nowadays you get arrested because you wouldn't have permits. You wouldn't, you know, you didn't get permission from the people to do it. So.
Well, another example of the importance of Chicago and Lake Michigan is your first directing a feature film, Lake Boat. What a cast you have. You've got Peter, you mentioned Peter Falk earlier. You got Peter Falk, you've got Charlie Durning, you got Dennis Leary, you've got George Wendt. I mean, you've got one hell of a cast.
I got Andy Garcia not one piece of dialogue, not one word. He doesn't sign a thing.
But he's good in the flashback.
Excellent. Oh, he had always told me he wanted to do a silent movie. So when I got the script to Lake Boat and realized how I wanted to shoot that stuff with that character and that I didn't want him to be able to speak, I called Andy and said, if you're up for it, I want to give you your shot to make a silent movie. Because in this, it's a David Mamet movie. A guy who's known for his dialogue. You're not going to have one line in. So he got it. Andy is smart enough and talented enough to say, I get it. I'll do it. And it was wonderful.
Well, he is. Actually, the guy who knocked me out the most in it was Robert Forster. I thought he was sensational. Oh, by the way, it's on the web too. You can see that movie. Yeah, on the web. And right. I watched it from beginning to end, and I was so impressed with a wonderful ending, the way you did it, with everybody's back. You've gotten to know all these characters, and the young man who was like Alice in Wonderland. This kid is coming in to be an intern on a ship, a freighter, and he meets the most unbelievable disparate characters to learn about life. Right. But such a lovely way to end with all their backs. And of course, he goes to his mom. But the big thing is to see all these characters walking away from him, but they've left him. They've left him with a wonderful, wonderful legacy.
Right. And you know, you had mentioned the thing about Mammoth, you know, having done the job that he had written about with Koindiri. He'd also did that job on Lake Boat. That's where he got the thing from. That he actually did a summer on the Lake Boat.
Yeah.
So that, and that character, that his brother, Tony, that was his brother playing the young man on it, that basically was base, you know, that's what the impetus for that.
So let's go to an unbelievable run of 35 years, I believe, of Fat Tony, this voice on The Simpsons. Did you start out with Jim Brooks or write with Matt Groening? Or did Jim get involved initially?
I think, I'm not sure. I think they were both there to film, but it was their third season of the show. So I think they were both there already. And Matt certainly was there. And what's interesting is I just did a reading, they did a read through of my most current episode as Fat Tony, because I'm still doing it. And it is by far the most major Fat Tony role I've ever done. This is the one. They even told me, they said, your next Fat Tony role, this is the one. I'm thinking, I've had a couple that were, you know, that the character was pretty much the featured main kind of character in the episode. This one is transcended all of them. And it's like, we haven't even recorded it yet, but we did the read through and it was like, wow. So, I mean, it was very exciting for me.
Well, I've been told, and it may not be true, you'll straighten me out quickly, but I've been told that the read-through on The Simpsons has an audience at the beginning. That people
it does.
That's true then. Yeah.
It's the best ticket in town to get that. In other words, it's limited. In other words, but what's great is Groening is great, and Groening is, you know, he's still like a boy in a man's body, you know. So he gets that. So, like at this last read-through we did, just last week, a lot of young people and, you know, kids of the writers and stuff like that. And they all get a script and they all have chairs. They're all sitting in a circle around the room. And what's great about it is it's better than going to the recording, because recording is just pieces of, you know, and bits and pieces. And maybe not everybody is there at the same time. This is the only time you're going to hear the thing in its entirety from beginning to end with all the voices in one room. So it's the best ticket in town. So yeah, there's an audience. And it helps the writers too, because they're hearing the reactions and stuff. We used to do it on Criminal Minds. We still do it. We have to do it by Zoom now because of the whole, since COVID, you know, they get a little gun shy. It's filling rooms up with people. But even on Criminal Minds, we do our read through of the new episode, and you can invite guests and stuff like that. And I think it's very beneficial. It helps us as actors because it gives us a sense of performance and doing the thing in one. Because when you're shooting a movie, especially, you're not necessarily going to be in every scene. So you're not going to have that experience of what it's like to hear the whole thing at one time, hear everybody in the same room and hear the thing from beginning to end. So it's a really great way of working. And so like for The Simpsons, definitely, it's the best ticket in town. Come to that read-through.
I'm assuming, no concept that when you went in to do this role of Fat Tony, that it would be something that would go on and on, right?
Yeah. I thought it was a one-shot deal. The movie Godfather 3 had just come out in December of 90. And of course, as you can imagine, it was very much anticipated. It was the third part of the Godfather trilogy. And I'm playing the main bad guy, Joey Zaza. So the movie was still running. And this was like now February of 91. The movie is still out there in the theaters. And I get this thing would you like to play this character, Fat Tony in The Simpsons? So I read it and I go, okay, this is fun. I loved it. It was a lot of fun. And I get it. I'm thinking, sure, they want me to do it because I'm the most visible, bad guy in this ilk out there right now. So it makes sense that they want to kind of capitalize on that. So, of course, I did it thinking, that's it. I'll do it. It'll be that one-shot deal. What was important to me is not use my own voice because I didn't want to sound like Joey Zaza, because I thought that'd be, Coppola would have a heart attack because he'd be going, oh, God, he's got my movie out here and he's got plenty of characters of cartoon. Right. So I chose to do my Uncle Willie's voice because my uncle, Uncle Willie really better talk like this. So that's why I decided to use that voice, thinking, oh, Willie will get a kick out of it, if nothing else, and that'll be that. Well, little did I know that the episode would resonate with enough of the Simpson crowd and Matt and whoever to say, oh, let's bring this guy back. Oh, let's bring this guy back again. Well, I've been doing it now 35 years. So I guess, I'd safely say that, Fat Tony is part of the fabric of who the Simpsons are, yeah.
It certainly seems to appear to be. Now, how does Criminal Minds come to you? I know that there was a change in character, but we don't have to get into that. But how does it come to you? Do you remember?
What I think was helpful with that is that I had done a series called Joan of Arcadia.
Oh, yes.
Two seasons, which was a wonderful series. I loved doing it very much. It was very personable to me, too, because, just everything about it was about something. It was spiritual, yet not religious. It was just, I thought it was really well written. And so I wanted to do it. So I did. But what ultimately happened, it only ran two seasons. And then when that show ended, what often happens is, okay, now everybody's out of work. The whole crew is now out of work. The showrunner is out of work. The producing guy. They go on to go do a pilot for a new show where they were packing up all the stuff from Joan of Arcadia. I remember I went to pick up probably my last check for the series. And I see them packing up boxes and they all said Criminal Minds on them. And I said, what's that mean? They go, oh, they're doing this new pilot up in Toronto. And the same producer that did Joan of Arcadia and the same crew, they're just all going to go do this new show. And I wished them all luck. I said, oh, great. Well, good luck. Maybe you guys will have better luck than me. Well, they go ahead and do it for 2 years. Ultimately happens, this opportunity arises when one character leaves the show. And it happened kind of abruptly. There wasn't a lot of lead time of like, oh, we knew we're going to have to cast this new character, sometime next year or something. It happened like on Monday, they thought everything was fine. Tuesday, they lost the character. We got to, now what do we do? And we're in production. We're already filming. So all of a sudden, all these different names, I guess, are being thrown around. Well, luckily for me, the entire crew, for the most part, 90% of the crew was from Joan of Arcadia, as was the showrunner. And they go to the showrunner now of the show, or the creator of the show, Ed Bernero, who was an ex-Chicago cop, Italian, former Chicago cop. So that kind of helped too. Yeah. They go to him and they said, hey, what about Joe Montana? We just worked with him on Joan of Arcadia and we all like him. What do you think? And he was like, Joe Montana? Let me call him in. Let me meet with him. And of course, within 10 minutes, Ed and I hit it off. Him being Italian, him being a Chicago cop, I said, gee, Ed, the only thing that separates us is you're a White Sox fan and I'm a Cubs fan. And if we can resolve that, this is a good fit. Well, as it turned out, it worked out. They said, look, they had already shot like 3 or 4 episodes. They were going to know right in how to create that I come into, they made it work that I'm one of the guys that started it, had retired, became an author, and now decided to come back and they would create this whole little interesting story why I came back. And we did it. And again, I didn't know how long it would be. My feeling was, okay, this looks, I like these people I've met. I didn't know anybody in the cast, but it was like, I'll do this for, God willing, a couple of years. They shoot it not far from my house. What could be better? Little did I know you know, my hair was black then. I mean, I was, this was 2007.
Yeah.
19 years.
Yeah. 19 years. We're about to start our 20th season. It'll be my 18th year on the show.
And you had reason to understand that after Joan of Arcadia, and we should talk a little bit about First Monday, even with great cast, good writing, shows get canceled. So the idea that you're going to, you know, it's impossible to understand it.
Yeah, no. You'd have no control over that. Yeah, nobody goes into a show thinking, oh, God, we're going to be on for 20 years. No, yeah. Nothing is out.
Well, some of them do, but they end up in, you know, Forest Lawn, maybe. But
So, I mean, you go away, but, you know, the quality of the writing has maintained. We all are very close to each other. It's a wonderful group. I feel very blessed. I mean,
as number one on the call sheet of a successful show, I'm sure you have things to say. Have you been able to bring in some of your ideas of your character? I mean, for example, I'm sure you've added things perhaps from your own life, like cooking. Cooking, absolutely. I know.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I learned that Don Belisario, when I did First Monday, going back to that, where I did my first dabbling into being number one on the call sheet for a series about the Supreme Court. Only lasted 13 episodes, but I learned a lot. First of all, that I learned I could carry an hour drama being the lead character, and you know, okay, it's daunting, but I can handle this. But one thing I learned from Don, what he told me early on, when we first talked about doing the show, he said, you should have control over who your character is in terms of a lot of things, ethnicity, this, that, the other. He said, if I were you, I would pick something close to who you are, because there's no way of knowing how long you're going to be doing this.
Yeah.
As it turned out, we did 13 and gone. But had it been like Criminal Minds, where I'm doing it for the next 20 years, you want to try to pick something that maybe you can feel comfortable with, tapping into things that you can relate to because you play on a character for about 20 years. So if I'm going to decide, I think I'll do him as a German immigrant with a German accent and a limp, all of a sudden I'd be locked into and for what? So I made that character an Italian-American, and I named him after my grandfather, Joe Novelli. And I brought in, that my family had been in Cicero, Illinois, had family there. And it only played for 13 episodes, but it was so comfortable because I was drawing on a lot of who was me. So I learned that from Don. And so now when I got onto Criminal Minds, I made that same choice. I said, we'll make an Italian American. His name's David Rossi. There was a reason I even picked that name. There's a whole story behind that. And then the writers would incorporate just a lot of who, you know, aspects of maybe who I would be. As an Italian American, and so yes, there's a lot of Joe Mantegna, you know, suddenly in the character buried within the character of David Ross. There's a lot about him that's not me, of course, as well, but it helps to be rooted in something that's comfortable and familiar, especially if you're going to do it for 20 years.
Yeah, I think your character. Or was a Marine in Vietnam?
Marine. That was important to me because I was in the military, which I wasn't, but a lot of my family was. I've been hosting the National Memorial Day Concert in Washington with Gary Sinise now for well over 20 years. I tried to join the Marines when I was 19, and I failed the eye test because I wanted to be a pilot, and I found out I had 20/200 vision, and that's why to this day I wear contact lenses. And then I was able to add my dear friend Meshack Taylor, who's the guy who turned me on to the series Criminal Minds. I didn't even know the show existed. Yeah. He said, "You called Joey. You got to watch this show. It's great." So I was able to see a couple episodes before I was even introduced to it. And so I was able to get him on the show as my former commanding officer in Vietnam. And we did a whole arc for his character, a 3-episode arc. And then the actor actually passed away. It was one of my dearest friends. We did the play Hair together, him and my wife and I. You know, Meshack goes back that far. So that last episode, and I directed those last two with him. And well, he wasn't in the last one because he had passed away, the actor. But we actually did a full Marine funeral. I flew in two Marine generals that I knew from Washington, D.C. because of my work with the Memorial Day Concert First Room. So I have a very strong association with the military, period, and Marines specifically, because of my association with Criminal Minds. So yeah, all of that has come into play. There's here in Los Angeles, there's a place called New Directions, and it's a facility for former military who are either drug addicted, alcohol addicted, homeless, whatever. They take them in, they teach them a trade, and it's run like a military, and really help these people. And I'm very active. I've been a spokesperson for them for many years. I was able to incorporate that into that episode so that the character, Wyshek's character, because it starts off where he's an alcoholic and he's homeless on the streets. We build him up and I bring him to New Directions. And so they're able to get a plug in a way, a real organization that does such good work on this, you know, very popular worldwide television program. So it's all good. You know, that's all for me. I'm thrilled that we've been able to do that.
Well, besides admiring your acting ability, I'm so impressed with your loyalty factor. And when you look at your career, you see, as I mentioned, that first little short movie, you starred with Jack Wallace. Jack Wallace ends up in the first big feature with a good role that you take care of. Same with Criminal Minds. Now, show business is not necessarily noted for that kind of behavior. And so if I wore a hat, I would tip it to you. It's what, let's say that to you. Okay, I'm going to talk to you, as I said earlier, 82 movies, but I have to tell you the one that knocked me out, the one I've never forgotten, and I don't even know if you'd guess it, so I won't ask you to, but it's Searching for Bobby Fischer.
That's a special movie.
Oh, my God. What a film. What a performance you give. And even though I'm not a parent, and I know you are a parent of two, it must have been unbelievable to bring, as you said earlier, from your life as a parent to try to see how you can help this young man.
Yeah. No, it's one of those blessed kind of circumstances where everything comes together. You got a script that's just incredibly written. You've got the wonderful cast. I remember we're just finishing the movie Bugsy. When I got the script for Searching for Bobby Fischer, and I heard that Ben Kingsley had been offered a role in it as well, and so I was at some function for Bugsy, and I saw Ben, and I had just gotten the script the day before, and I read it, and I said, Ben, I heard you got the script from Bobby Fischer too, didn't you? He goes, yeah. I said, did you read it? He goes, yeah. I said, what do you think? He goes, well, Joe, I think it's one of the finest scripts I've ever read in my life. And I went, okay, I'm not crazy. I said, Ben Kingsley did so too. I said, okay, good, because I just wanted to make sure it wasn't just me, because I read it and went, oh my God, this is special. I mean, so special that the next film that Steve Zaillian wrote was Schindler's List. Yeah, he was working on that while we were shooting Bobby Fischer. So, I mean, it was just one of those things. Everything came together. It's a true story. Steve is such a tremendous writer. The performances, the kid was great. You know, thank God the kid... You know, he had to be cast first because even the kid was like 8 years old who knew enough about chess that could pull this off. So you don't have to teach a kid chess because they're just too intricate part of the movie. Luckily, the kid, you know, had brown eyes and dark hair. If he'd have been a blonde, blue-eyed kid, I don't think that would have been considered the role of his dad.
Or you'd be having to play blue contacts in that.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. Luckily, I got on the short list because of the way the kid looked. That, you know, okay, that kind of matches up. Joan Alapi, my wife's a wonderful actress who I've known for years in Chicago. So, no, if I had to pick, you know, one of the five most favorite films I've done in my life, Bobby Fischer, of course, is right in there without question. And it's just a beautiful movie.
Yeah. I'm glad that you feel that way because, as I say, as an audience member, I never forgot it. It's a very, very moving.
One thing that happened that was interesting, I was at the White House. I was at the Kennedy Center Committee for some years, the Kennedy Center Honors. And during the Clinton administration, Al Gore came up to me. He was vice president at the time. And we were at a cocktail party or something that weekend. And he says, "Oh, Mr. Mateo, I want to tell you something." His son had an accident where he was climbing up on a roof and had fallen and broken his legs or something, had been hospitalized for a while. And he was in the hospital. He was immobile. He had to have his legs in casts for a while. So he couldn't do anything but lay in the bed for, months. He said him and his son bonded on that movie, searching for Bobby Fischen, and then they would start playing chess, every day in the hospital. And so he was so grateful for that film. And so to hear that story from Al Gore was, personalized it in a way that was like, oh, wow, that's great. Thank you. I'm so glad that movie had such impact for me personally.
Were you a chess player, or are you a chess player?
I'm as good a chess player as the character I played. My kid would beat me in a heartbeat. I knew how to play the game, but no, it was. There's that great scene where kids, the kids in the bathtub and making moves, and then and beating me. So,
in looking over this incredible career, Joe, was there a role that took you a long time to get? And did you get it? Was it a real difficult role? What do you think, in looking back, was one of the more difficult roles? And do you think you got it?
I'll say this. I thought one of the most challenging ones was to play Dean Martin in the Rat Pack, because I knew I would be playing a real-life individual and that millions and millions of people would have in their mind, well, I know who Dean Martin is. So now my job is to not convince them that I am Dean Martin, but that I can suspend their belief for a couple hours that I'm portraying Dean Martin. So that was daunting in that I wondered and worried a bit about that. But I worked very hard at that. And I did a lot of research on it, on his voice, his mannerisms. I studied films of him. I did everything I could to try to, not to imitate him, but just to try to bring the semblance of who I thought Dean Martin would be on screen. And I felt pretty good about it, in the sense that ultimately it's the only role that I've actually been nominated for both the Golden Globe and an Emmy for that role. And I was embraced by members of Dean's family to this day, where Dean and Martin, his daughter, her and I are so very, very close. And they really, embraced it and appreciated at least what they felt my performance was. So I felt that was probably one of the most daunting, because I knew it would be under the microscope for so many of, like, are you, you're Dean Martin? And for me, part of one of the more interesting tidbits about that is how I came up with the voice to at least sound somewhat in that ballpark. And I thought to myself, as listening to him, I thought, he reminds me of when I was a kid, and there would be that rice sugar crisp commercial, and the sugar bear would talk like this. Can you remember that sugar crisp? Oh, sugar bear here. And I thought to myself, that kind of way that Dean Martin would talk. So the same guy that would say, yeah, you remember that sugar crisp, would say, oh, how are these people get in my room? And that floor kind of came up with the voice of Dean, but I would think about the sugar bear.
Yeah.
And to this day, Dean Martin loves that 20-hour.
Well, it is terrific. I wanted to ask you about, did you ever quit? You don't have to say the show or film. Did you ever quit a film or a show or a theater?
I never, not that I could think of where I quit. I got replaced once. I think the picture was The Marrying Man. It was the one where actually Alec Baldwin met his first wife.
Kim Basinger?
That's where they met. That movie. And I'm supposed to be playing. What it was is, and Neil Simon, I think, wrote the script.
He did.
Yeah, and I was playing, I was playing a gangster. I think I was playing Bugsy Siegel or something like that, even though I did the movie Bugsy, but in this instance, I think I was playing Bugsy Siegel. But there was almost like it was a Disney film, and there was like a little bit of a misunderstanding, I think, in terms of the guy who directed it was he was a Disney director who had done The Brave Little Toaster or something. He had done a lot of animated stuff, but he hadn't really worked with real actor, live stuff much.
Yeah,
he didn't have a lot of experience in that. I'm not blaming him, but it was just a little different way of communicating. And when I read the script, I really felt that this character was somewhat, there was a certain tongue-in-cheek quality to him. And I remember when I read the script, I even brought that up to them. I said, you know, this character, I don't want to play him too serious because, again, the movie The Godfather 3 was still out then. And I thought, I can't do a duplication of Joey Zaza with this guy. I said, this guy seems a lot different. He's got a little kind of this humorous side to it. That's right. That's exactly what we're looking for. Well, after the second day of filming, they came to me and they said, you know, we think it's got to go. And they're telling me to go exactly the way that I said I can't do, that I wouldn't do.
Yeah.
And I said, well, we talked about this, didn't we? And they said, yeah, but you're thinking now. And they said, well, what do you think? And basically they said they were willing to eat the two, because they hadn't done much of those first 2 days. They said, well, we get it. And if you feel like maybe you want to not continue, well, we can live with that. And I could tell they were like, that's fine with them. It's fine with me. And that's it.
I'm not going to end this interview on that note. I'll enter it this way. In looking back professionally on your career up until now, what would one or two of the big highlights be? Would you say? We may have talked a couple of them already, but
we've talked about a lot, and we've covered a lot. Look, the first thing I did professionally was to play Hair, and because of it, I wound up with the woman I've spent my whole entire life with and children.
Right.
So there's no doubt about starting my professional career that way. Coming from the background that came from having the family I've come from. And so in terms of a career, and so, you know, when I think about it, like you say, you go with the work. I've never counted how many things I've done, and it amazes me to think that, but I look at myself, I'm thinking, yeah, look, my hair's white now. And like, I'm going to be 79 years old in November and blow this guy in the FBI. It's all been a highlight. Do you know what I mean? Having the profession I have, my worst day on a set is probably as good as most people's best day on their job.
There you go. That's okay.
Sorry, I got no complaint. You know, I'm not. I talk to the guy who's putting a bumper on a car every 4 minutes in the, you know, I'm up in Michigan for General Motors, and ask him, yeah, how you feel? Yeah, how much have you enjoyed doing that for the last 30 years of your life? You know, he might just say, well, it's been okay. I have friends and it's all the ring. But, you know, all been a highlight.
You don't sound like a man who has a bucket list. That's what I would say.
Well, I never did. I never did. I always say, what do we want to do next? I go, I don't know. I didn't know I was going to do this till the phone rang. No.
That's right. Joe Mantegna, you are terrific. Thank you so much for joining
you
me.
Are, you are as well. I haven't enjoyed doing this kind of an interview with someone as much for many, many years because you are a unique individual yourself.
You're very kind. But I hope one day, I have to hurry up, but I hope one day we can work together. Anyhow.
I'd love it.
Thanks for joining us on Julian Schlossberg's Movie Talk. Remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world. Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.